When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jachinski, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts and to the premium version of our website. Today, we're joined by one of the newest Federalist contributors. That would be the one and only Peachy Keenan. She is the author of the new book. It is out on June 6th, Domestic Extremist, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. You can also follow Peachy's work over at peachykeenan.substack.com. Peachy, welcome to Federalist Radio Hour.
Hey, Emily. It's my pleasure to be here.
It's very funny referring to you as Peachy in conversation because for those listeners who aren't on conservative Twitter, Peachy Keenan is obviously a pseudonym that you use for a variety of reasons. You write about those reasons in the book. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit here, because I think it's probably a very interesting story. I know you can't get into too many details or specifics about why you are anonymous and why you sort of left your career, as you say, quote, writing for corporate behemoths to do what you're doing now.
Yeah, I mean, that is basically why I had to sort of adopt a pseudonym. I first started like getting on Twitter probably around Trump, the Trump era, 2015, 2016. I just wanted a way to like comment on politics and express my opinions as a conservative woman, which, you know, you can't really do where I live in Los Angeles in polite company. And then I finally started the Peachy Keenan account in 2019. I wanted it to have like a real name just to, it was just like a fun, you know, kind of ironic, like everything's Peachy Keen when it wasn't. And at the time I was working for a very, yeah, like you said, a very large, very well-known entertainment media company in Southern California. So for obvious reasons, you know, expressing your opinions online, writing my articles for The American Mind, which I started doing in 2019 as Peachy, those would not have been very well received at my day job because I had a full-time day job and I was writing for them and working with, you know, people who they would have stoned me on site. Okay. If they had like seen my Twitter or knew how I felt about things, I would have been beheaded. They would have brought in a guillotine. Like it would have been over for me. And so, you know, the anonymity is really protective. It's very cozy and you feel like, you know, maybe you are not going to get doxxed or canceled immediately. You know, right around the time the pandemic started, my work with that company basically ended because of the pandemic. A large number of people's or the contracts were not renewed. People were giant departments were laid off directly as a result of COVID. And so that was sort of freeing, you know, I mean, it's a little scary to lose like the security of a day job, but it was also like a great opportunity for me to just sort of double down, you know, like, all right, well now I'm peachy. And how far can I take this thing? And very soon after that, you know, I got a book deal and things just sort of took off from there. So now, you know, sometimes still when I wake up in the morning, I have to kind of like blink my eyes a few times and remember like, oh yeah, I'm Peachy Keenan. Like, what am I going to say today?
I get to wake up and be a domestic extremist again.
That's right. That's right.
Well, yeah, that is really interesting because to the extent that your story is representative of many others, I mean, I think that's important to the book because that's sort of the central thesis here is that domestic extremism is not extremism. And it's in fact the norm. But I want to also ask before we get into that about your conversion to Catholicism, because I have to imagine that was a really important part of your story. You have four kids, you're married, this is all what makes you an extremist. But I think that's particularly interesting So in your timeline, you know, you start writing this stuff around 2019, pandemic comes, you have this moment of liberation, ideologically. How have your personal beliefs evolved? How did your conversion to Catholicism and your faith sort of play into all of that?
Yeah, I actually have more than four kids. Just want to fact check that for
Whoa,
the record.
Okay.
I know. I'm extremely domestic. Okay. I'm in the big leagues. Well, yeah, I mean, like I say in the book, there's some memoir in the book about how, you know, my quote unquote journey from like basic liberal, you know, Democrat, socially liberal, feminist. I was a pro-choice militant, secular atheist. I thought people who believed in religion were stupid. That's the flyover people. I'm this, you know, smart coastal elitist. You know, I was a snob about it totally. Like all liberals in California and New York are today. Like, they don't like people who believe in anything, are just proves that they're idiots. But I slowly became a conservative, basically right around 9/11. I kind of, you know, the liberalism sort of fell from my eyes. And then later on, I became more socially conservative. I started dating my husband. He sort of kind of red pilled me a little bit on things like abortion and gun control. I mean, it's like the power of a masculine man, okay, to woo a liberal woman and like convert her, like that, it works. Like, you men out there, like you can fix her, okay? You really can. And then in terms of Catholicism, that was sort of my final kind of iteration of you know, my extreme domesticity. And the process began when my husband and I were newly married. I got pregnant. We were thrilled. And at 3 months, I had a miscarriage. And, you know, it was very dramatic, unexpected. We were both like completely unprepared. You know, we had not. Now we're sort of battle hardened, as you are, you know, once you've had a miscarriage, you're braced, you know, every time you get pregnant. But at the time, we were just like lambs to the slaughter. And we had no idea, you know, oh, my gosh, what? This can happen at this stage. And like, we were devastated. And he told me, he's like, listen, I'm so upset. I have to convert to Christianity. I'm becoming a Catholic. And I was like, what? I mean, I didn't, you know, this is not what I signed up for, you know, but I loved him and I was not going to like stop anyone from doing that, obviously. So he started the process of going to RCIA, and I was sort of reluctantly accepting of it. My family was sort of semi-horrified, like, oh no, like, you married this religious fundamentalist. Like, what were you thinking? But just the process of him going through it and me kind of going through it with him, going to mass, reading things, just understanding. And I had come from zero knowledge of any of this, right? That process led to my own conversion. And I was pregnant again, and I very quickly had three children under the age of three. So I wasn't even able to find like shoes that matched, you know, for a few years. But once I did, I started my own conversion, and it's been about 10 years now. And, you know, what can I tell you? Like, if you want a shortcut to all this stuff, if you want a great way to immunize your kids and inoculate yourself to the, you know, to the woke mind virus, Roman Catholicism is a great way to do that. With this one neat trick, you could just like cut right to the end.
So that's very helpful, because I didn't realize that the kind of 10-year scale thing, but it makes a lot of sense. And I guess it also makes sense to the extent that you write. I really liked this line. I think this is actually just from the introduction. You say, instead, you'll simply begin to make choices, large and small, that come not from without, but from deep within. And to me, that's a really optimistic note. And it goes along with the optimism, I think, of what you just said, even if it was more implicit. You're saying that the human instinct that women have, also that men have, you have the whole section on men in the book, that can kind of rescue us from, you know, this extremism that we consider normal now, or we're supposed to consider normal, and back to just being normal. Do you think that's true? Do you think that, do you have hope that there are a lot of other, you know, Peachy Keenans out there who maybe won't take the step of becoming, you know, anonymous right wing? I was going to say shit posters, but maybe that's inappropriate.
No, that's fine. I like that. I like that handle.
But do you have hope that there are other people out there? Again, maybe they don't, you know, do a career pivot, or maybe their career pivot looks like staying at home, something like that, or homeschooling. Are there more people like you out there who are coastal elites, left of center, who will just sort of naturally come around because they start having kids and get married?
Yes, I think there are. I mean, I've met some of them. And I think that the pandemic really woke, radicalized a lot of people to the reality of like public school education and the teachers' unions and what they actually want with your kids. People tell me all the time that they reach out to me on Twitter and they say, you know, I used to be this way and I had a change of heart. I used to be on the dating market and, you know, Tinder apps, and I finally woke up to the reality of that wasn't helpful for me. So I think that a lot of women are, it really just takes them hearing the right message or like seeing the right kind of persuasive argument or seeing them, their own lives, how they've been affected by, you know, single-minded focus on a career, to the, sacrificing like their natural inborn fertility, or they've been forced in these positions of finding themselves later in life, you know, child-free, maybe by accident, and now it's sort of too late. So I think the culture, the liberals are actually helping me radicalize. They're doing a great job of radicalizing women against feminism. And young men especially seem to be kind of leading the vanguard there. You know, I mean, there was a study that just came out that showed like Gen Z men are hugely against feminism more than women. And like at least half or something. So not like, you know, overwhelming majority of Gen Z men, but this is like guys like 18 to 25 or whatever. And the reason that not many of them are anti-feminist or whatever, or see that it's all bull, is because they're in the trenches. Like they're in college with these chicks, you know, they're seeing what these women are like. And so that the reality on the ground is doing a great job of kind of red-pilling people against this stuff. But like you said, what I say in the book, like turning inward, you know, I'm not really revealing anything like completely new under the sun. You know, I'm not discovering any novel ideas. Like these things are so kind of ancient and timeless, and they're all in us from the beginning. Like we're all born with these very natural, you know, normal instincts, ways to feel, like how a mother should feel about her baby, a man and woman falling in love. Like these are just like normal ways of being human, that if you can kind of like brush away the like scales of feminism or progressivism and uncover them, you can kind of, you know, reveal what the person's true desires are, which they're not allowed to say anymore. You know, like, I don't know if you had this experience, but I had friends when I had my corporate job in the office, I would have friends who would, you know, young women marry for a few years, get pregnant, and they would tell me how reluctant they were to come back to work when their paid leave was over. Like it was like 4 to 6 weeks, you know, and they were like, I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I can come back. And some of them I would say, listen, you don't have to. Like when you have your baby, you know, it's going to be hard to say goodbye to the kid for 12 hours a day when he's 6 week old. Like if you listen to your heart, you know, it will tell you what you need to do. And yes, it's a sacrifice. Yes, you might like lose whatever, a few years of your income. But some of them did take my advice, and I was very pleased to see that some of these women were much happier. They stayed home with their newborn. They had a second newborn. But then on the other hand, there were some who came right back, and I would just look at them like, wow, that's, I don't know if I could have done that. So I hope that there is a way to sort of reach the hearts and minds of these young women.
Yeah, at the Federalist, you're actually not allowed to advance unless you have children.
Nice. I love it. Every kid.
It's really the Handmaid's Tale over here.
Every kid gets you into a higher tax bracket, right?
Yes.
That's how it should be.
On that note, though, you have a section in the book where you talk about birth control as mind control. And mm-hmm. I love that phrasing because it raises this issue of like, I think the birth control pill, we're on the precipice of a real reckoning with it. It is the one thing, if you could point to something that just was a technological innovation that changed the world really quickly without much thought, because the conveniences were so obvious, especially to the people who were peddling it. But it just sort of dramatically changed human nature overnight. And I think, you know, with more than a half century in the rearview mirror, this is at least slowly starting to change. So if you could, you know, with that kind of context that we are starting to see more people question, you know, pharma's claims about birth control versus their experiences with it, especially since it started getting prescribed to, you know, women in my generation, millennial generation, for acne and everything when they were like 13 years old and they've been on the pill for 10 years, are going to have fertility issues because of it in some likelihood. What does it mean that it also, in addition to being, you know, the control sexually, physically, how is it also mind control?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the name of it is so dystopian. You know, birth control, it sounds like some way to like cull the herd or something. It's crazy, right? I think it's mind control in a way. I think in the book I say it's like, it's a form of like Chekhov's gun, you know, like Anton Chekhov, the playwright, he had a famous quote attributed to him that if you're writing a play and in act one, you show a loaded gun, you know that that gun will be fired by act three. So if you show a girl, a young woman, teenager or whatever, the pill, and like, here's what it will do for you. Here are all the benefits. Like, you can do whatever you want with a boy and no consequences. Like, pretty sure that that will be getting, the pill will be being, will get, she'll test it out. Like, she's going to see if it works, and she's going to know that she's, her innards have been, her uterus has been up armored and she's been sterilized and she is ready to party. You know what I mean? And so you have a much, I think, higher likelihood of women being open to, you know, promiscuity, dating apps, like long strings of, you know, high body counts, as they say, in terms of numbers of sexual partners. And, you know, the whole idea of like chastity, I mean, could there be a dirtier word in the English language than chastity, or even suggesting to a young woman that that might be healthier choice than medicalizing herself on lifetime synthetic hormones? And now we're seeing more and more, like you said, the after effects of birth control. Not only do they make you kind of gain weight, and like, you know, do they work by literally making a woman like not want to have sex? Like, they make you asexual, they lower libido. And there was some other study that said that women on long-term birth control actually become lesbians. Like, they're just so almost allergic to masculinity because of the pill that they're on, that it kind of induces this, you know, antinatalism. And so, yeah, I mean, I think Mary Harrington has been writing about the pill a lot, Louise Perry, a lot of these sort of like radical traditional feminists, the sort of like new group of women writers that's coming up, because the after effects are no good. And yeah, my, you know, I remember my sister got put on the pill for acne, and she had problems later in her life. She had PCOS, she really struggled to have children. And so, I mean, I'm not 100% sure it's related. But I mean, you cannot lightly just put a 13-year-old on the pill. I mean, what message are you sending as the mother? That you, what are you hoping her to do when she's 13 or 14 years old, you know?
Yeah, it's the way that, but that's, to me, this question of, one of the biggest questions I had when I was reading the book is this sort of relativity between normality and extremism. And increasingly, I think that what is normal and what is normal in sort of an idealistic sense, what are healthy norms, are becoming not just framed as domestic extremism by the media, but when you look at how sort of accepting everyone is of these premises, like the Orwellian term birth control. I mean, look at how pervasive the question of, quote, forced birth has been after Hobbes, which is insane. there's this like really, I think, tough dynamic. And I don't have the answer, but I do wonder if we're already so far gone that it is genuinely extreme to be what used to be considered normal. Do you have thoughts on that, especially in a world where, I mean, I think birth control is a really indicative pendulum that seems to start swinging back, but then I also think it's such a tool of hedonism that I have a hard time seeing humans ever give it up. So it as a sort of stand-in for other conveniences and comforts that, you know, we have in this hedonistic world, can we go back, or are the normies now destined to be extreme long-term?
Yeah, I mean, that really is the question, isn't it? It's like, are we going to win the culture war or not? You know, are we going to save Western civilization or not? I mean, you can see the effects of birth control are having these profound population impacts everywhere, and not just the first world, not just, you know, Japan and Europe, but now all over, even Mexico and Central America. Their birth rates used to be high. But I think now the only really major, you know, extremely high birth rates are pretty much in sub-Saharan Africa. They're the last ones to go. So we're kind of all committing genetic self-suicide, as I say. We're choosing extinction. And, you know, a lot of people, not just me, are talking about this. I mean, Elon Musk talks about this a lot. He's sort of like the highest profile, you know, pro-natalist that we have. And he talks about population collapse as like the existential problem. You know, sorry, you know, climate change people, like, your thing is not as important as this. And so, you know, are we destined to just be a tiny minority on the fringes, you know, homesteaders and homeschoolers and domestic extremists, like toiling away as everyone else jumps off the cliff? You know, I don't think so. I think that most people at the end of the day do not want to die alone. They do not want to die with no children, no grandchildren, no legacy, no one to remember them, no one to visit their grave, just their cats, you know, to eat their body when they die in their studio apartment. I think that most people don't want that. The trick is, how do you get them to admit that, you know? And like fight these very entrenched, as you say, cultural taboos against even talking about this, against even suggesting to a woman that she should not be dating a new guy every weekend. You know, you should not be, you know, trying to get a very high body count to show off to your friends how hot you are or whatever it is, you know. But I think we're just going to have to peel them off one by one. And it's a 100-year march we have to take, basically.
Mm-hmm. And that's a helpful just framing, because we think about things in, you know, 1-year marches, maybe 10-year marches, but so much has changed. You know, we live in such a hyper novel world, as Brett Weinstein and Heather Hang would say, that you're the frog in the boiling pot and your head is spinning and you can't kind of keep track of how much is changing and how much it is changing. I think about that a lot when I think about sort of the experiment in norm shifting across the West when it comes to homosexuality, gay marriage, and that it's strange to me that there's been so little discussion about what the life might look like 40 years, 50 years, 60 years down the road, when the natural sort of relationship between a man and a woman has a lot of comfort and nurturing from the woman. And it's not to say a man can't provide it. It's just to say that men and women are biologically different. Therefore, the sort of complementary aspect of care is different. Having a biological child with your partner, with both genes, that obviously changes the way that you're sort of evolutionarily, you know, conditioned to live as you age and to be cared for as you age. So all of that is to say, there's just so little conversation about it. And we just sort of blaze ahead because certain things are, I guess, right now, the conditioning is so deep. And on that note, maybe you have thoughts on that. But also I wanted to ask you about, quote, industrial scale grooming, which is another fantastic term, because this all has been industrialized. It is big business and it is on a mass scale.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I talk about in the book in some detail is like the whole industry of egg donation, right? And, you know, where we're going with that kind of blindly, and what the consequences are to not just to the couples, like the childless couples, the infertile couples. You know, today it's mostly gay couples buying egg, you know, well, they're donated, but they're actually, you're buying eggs. But the consequences to the women who are donating, quote, donating their eggs, you know, sort of like an issue that's linked with surrogacy, you know, the women who are volunteering or whatever, being paid to be surrogates for couples who don't want to or can't carry their own babies to term. Again, largely gay couples. And, you know, these women are doing it for mostly this, you know, many of them are Christian, Mormon. There's a lot of egg donors in Utah. I did a lot of research on this, and they are kind of entranced by the idea of, you know, empathy, helping, you know, people who can't have their own children, sharing their wonderful youth and fecundity with those who are less fortunate, you know, and it comes from this place of love and
it's trying to tell love is love.
Yeah. And they're literally because they've absorbed so many of the Planned Parenthood messages and narrative that your eggs are not children. They're not even related to you. They're nothing. It's nothing. It's just a cell. You know, you imbibe that. I did as a teenage girl. You just believe that wholeheartedly, that it's not a baby until it comes out. Okay. Before that, it's up for grabs. Anyone can claim it. It is whatever you say it is. And so their eggs to them are nothing. And it's just like giving them a piece of dry skin, like it's not a fingernail clippings. And so they donate their eggs. They go through a very kind of rigorous, medically invasive, destructive process of egg harvesting. It's really gruesome what they do to you once you get sucked in. You're not paid very much money. And they harvest your eggs like you're a beluga sturgeon. They just like open you up and take out the eggs. And you're jacked up with crazy hormones and you're very young. And most of these women have never had a baby. They don't know if they'll ever have fertility problems. And their eggs are sold on these crazy websites that look like dating websites. They look like Tinder profiles with the women, young 20, 21 year old girls dressed provocatively, you know, bikini shots. Like it's really crazy. And like the blonde, blue-eyed ones are, you know, obviously the most popular, like even to liberals, you know, there's not a lot of diversity among the egg donation women. Just what does that mean? I don't know. Are the egg buyers, a bastion of white supremacy? I mean, like, yes, they are. that's who's buying, you know, the gay men and the women buying eggs are like, they're looking for a specific body type, 100%, thin, young, white, blonde, blue-eyed. And what I found in the book is that there's some terrible stories of women having egg donor regret, and a woman who was rendered, for example, totally infertile by the process of harvesting her eggs. And she found out that she had two biological children who were being raised by strangers in another state, and they would never know her. She would never be able to see them, touch them. And she was now infertile. And those were the only two children she would ever have. And now she herself was resorting to egg buying to have her own children. And just like, what a debacle, you know, it reminds me of like the detransitioners, these victims of the left, these victims of, you know, medical technology gone wrong. It's almost like one of the Aliens sequels, you know, just like this, you know. It's like this, these laboratories are doing these things with no consequence. Like you said, they're just full steam ahead, and there are consequences. And I hope that people can read about them and learn more about them and decide, you know what? I think I'm not going to sell my eggs. At least I hope.
Well, no, it's a great example. Like Katie Faust really, of Them Before Us, really opened my eyes up to this. And I think she's opened a lot of people's eyes up to this because there's certain artifacts of our culture that have, that are just kind of like baked into, because the industrial scale grooming is so powerful, they're really not questioned. Birth control and surrogacy, they're cast by corporations that run media outlets with that kind of love is love framing, with the, you know, technology is amazing and blah, blah, blah. It's all the same. And they've shoved this down people's throats in a matter of decades. And it's something striking about your book is how much of it goes back down to sex and biology. I mean, so much of what you're writing about, I mean, maybe most of it is sex and biology.
Yeah.
So I guess I wanted to ask why you think that's become the central sort of fight in the culture, or why does it at the end of the day? Why does so much of this come down to sex and biology?
I think it's been become clear to me why all of these things seem to be focused and targeting on young women who are at their most fertile, the time when they should be thinking about, you know, finding a mate and having children. Instead, they're being delivered this menu of options, reproductive technology, lifestyle options that include things like, you know, exploring your sexuality for the next 10 years, avoiding pregnancy, freezing your eggs, donating your eggs, getting abortions, getting on birth control. And it's very clear to me that the reason is because once you are a mother, you suddenly have something to protect, and you suddenly have something to conserve, and you suddenly have something, a vocation, a lifestyle that has nothing to do with your job, your boss, Joe Biden, the government, like society as a whole. Now it's like you, your mate, and your child against the world, you know, like the old Schoolhouse Rock song, three is a magic number, you know, a man and a woman have a little baby. And like that, now they're this like micro unit of, you know, the ultimate nuclear family. And breaking that apart is required. You know, the powers that be kind of have to break that apart in order to kind of reassert, you know, control over them, so they can continue selling them their products, their technology, their political ideologies. It's very, very important to them to break that apart and get access to the woman and the child in that family unit. And that's what the whole book is about. You know, become extremely domestic if you want to live, you know, prioritizing yourself, your relationship with your spouse, and protecting your children, and hopefully having more than a couple, like is the only path out that I see for all of us to take. You know, it's the only way to prevent them from kind of like stealing stealing your brain and like asserting their control over you. And so that's why they have to target the mothers. That's why they have to, you know, convince moms that it's okay to transition your six-year-old boy. That's fine to keep him, make him a medicalized patient for life. And they seem to be really going after the mothers. And a lot of mothers are going after it. I mean, they have like some mental problems, you know, among a lot of women who are doing it as a virtue signal or whatever. But yeah, it seems like very obvious why they're targeting women and girls. They're the soft underbelly of the culture.
Mm. That's another good transition, because the book includes a quiz, and as I was going through the quiz, I had the same again, the reaction, like, so much of this is in some way just ties to sex and ties to biology and to, you know, all of those sorts of things. Can you tell us just about making the quiz? Because it's basically a quiz to find out whether you're a domestic extremist, and we're not going to spoil all of it because you should go get that book, which again is out on June 6th. But tell us about coming up with this sort of litmus test for whether one is an extremist or not.
Yeah, I mean, I was called a domestic extremist by people when I was pregnant with my third kid. You know, a neighbor literally saw me coming home, like pregnant with my two little kids. And she was like, wait, are you pregnant again? And I was like, yes. And she's like, what are you, some kind of Mormon? You know, yeah. So I was
for the denim ankle length skirt.
Yeah. Like I was already some kind of like religious fundamentalist with three kids. Now, obviously she had two kids, because that's all you can fit, you know, in the back of the Mercedes or whatever. And I had like the minivan. I was ready to go. I'm ready to fill it up. Which we did. But yeah, I mean, you're just going to be marked as a domestic extremist by being living a normal life, or what used to be considered normal, you know, within recent memory. So the quiz, it's what is it called? How to know if you're a domestic extremist. Like you might be, like, you know, the old quiz, you might be a redneck if, like, you might be a domestic extremist if you, you know, want to get married one day, want to stay married, and want to be monogamous. If you don't want your spouse watching pornography, if you aspire to have, let's say, at least three children. If you think it's great for a mom to stay home and nurse her baby, you know, that makes you like all these things that were kind of taken for granted. That was just how you lived. These were not conservative ideas. These are not radical ideas. These are not alt-right ideas or whatever. This is just timeless. This is millennia people have been doing these things, but now they mark you as a very dangerous domestic extremist. That's the irony of the title. You know, it's just like wild how these very basic things have become, you know, taboo.
Yeah. No, wild is a great word for it. You've written for us about the kind of boycott trends right now. Obviously, on the front of a lot of people's minds are Target and Bud Light. And yeah, it's obviously difficult to put a number on what percentage of moms or what percentage of parents or what percentage of consumers, period. You know, Bud Light probably wouldn't be a bunch of moms protesting it en masse. That would be more like the barefoot Pinot Grigio, but with Bud Light is just a lot of, you know, sort of middle American people, and with Target, probably a lot of moms, parents, and the media is sort of chewing on this question of like, what's going on? There have been some explanations for Target's market downturn. You know, it's that time of year. There's just all of these things going on with Target, these business structural things. It's not about the boycott. What do you make of like the last, 2 months now of consumers starting to really seem to make their voices heard at the cash register?
Yeah, it's been amazing because, you know, people have tried to do boycotts before, you know, boycott Disney. That's been a perennial for the last 3 or 4 years. This one seems to be really hitting. And I think it really is because they jumped the shark with the Dylan Mulvaney Bud Light can. And now people that I know, at least anecdotally, are really having fun with it. Like they're sharing and getting excited about like the latest Bud Light stock price low, you know, like the normies are like loving it, like having fun with it. And it is becoming fun. It's like, now what else can we boycott? Like, what can we do now? Who else can we take down? Because, wow, we do have a little bit of power just as a regular person, as a regular consumer. I mean, will Dodgers games be less crowded? Like they look like they're pretty crowded still. Are Targets going to see actually fewer sales, like when it comes to like back to school time? I mean, that's an open question. The problem is like there aren't a lot of alternatives for a mom who makes her regular Target run where you can get diapers and school supplies, you know, and like makeup at the same store. Like there's no Walmart near me. And I don't know if I want to go to Walmart. Like I've seen too many Walmart fight videos. Like, I don't know if I, you know, like, I don't know if I.
That's part of the fun.
I'm going to bring my mace to Walmart. There's not a lot of alternatives yet. You know, Bud Light is easy because there's a million beer brands. There's not a million Targets. There's not a million Dodgers. So it remains to be seen if that will last. But the good news is I am hearing people and my own family, like we're done with Disney. Like we usually go, we were going like once a year. You know, we live in LA. I grew up going to the park. I love the park. We're probably not going to go for the foreseeable future. It's just finally the cons outweigh the pros. And I think that will be the case with Target. People will find alternatives. And I think that just people are having fun with it. It's like a tactic, you know, Saul Alinsky said, like, you know, always use tactics that your side enjoys. And so right now everyone's really enjoying this and I hope they keep having fun with it.
So that's also one of the big questions I think a lot of people are asking themselves. Like when you look at your trajectory, which I find very interesting and I've seen in other people's lives, maybe it's fair to say, you might disagree with this, but it might be fair to say that you went full trad. Like you did the full, like
you never, Emily, you never go full trad.
You never go full trad. That's so true. I'm going to get that tattooed. Never go full trad. But that's, you know, are things like guns and abortion, as much as like your average person looks at the tucking stuff at Target or kids themed pride clothing and just says like, get it out of my face. But, you know, they also don't have a lot of alternatives because Walmart, I'm sure, has plenty of DEI stuff, as does Kohl's. I saw that over the course of last week. That's lovely. So it's like, well, what are you supposed to do? You know, does my vote with my dollar even matter? The answer to that, I think, is pretty clearly, mostly no. I don't know. We're still in the stage of the experiment where it's not entirely obvious, but I would say it's, you know, probably no, and that's sort of the point of ESG. But all that aside, are those sort of baked in type cultural things that come with the things that maybe icked you out when you talk about how you were sort of a California snob towards the middle American camo wearing, you know, church going, Bible thumping folks? Is that going to be the thing that prevents Glenn Youngkin or Ron DeSantis from doing well in different places, whether it's the presidential election or another in, you know, gubernatorial races, Senate races. How powerful is that at sort of stopping, you know, potential peachies at the maybe halfway mark?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm joking about never go full trad. I mean, I live in, I'm still living in Los Angeles. I'm still from the outside, you know, I don't dress like I'm Amish. I don't have a farm. I'm not a homesteader. You know, I don't live off the grid.
Raw milk. This is the litmus test.
I'm fine with raw milk. I don't know where to get it. Here's the thing. Once they sell it at Trader Joe's, I'll try it. But until then, I don't know where a cow is. I don't want to touch a live chicken. Okay. I'm still very much a like suburban, you know, like spoiled, like American. I'm not a farmer. You don't have to be extremely domestic. That's the magic of this. You can do this anywhere. You can live this way in an apartment in New York City. It might be harder, but this is not about growing your own food. That's all great. People should definitely do those things and be less dependent. But part of the way that you make going trad, quote unquote, more popular, especially among, you know, coastal elitists, is you make it cool. And so, like, you know, the reason I always looked down my nose, I was a total awful snob, was because to me, being a conservative, being trad looked, it just looked kind of like, I don't know, wasn't cool, wasn't trendy, wasn't hip. It was, you know, I'm all for patriotism, but I was not going to be like in a pickup truck with a shotgun and with like antlers, like, you know, hunting culture. Like, I just couldn't relate to that. I wanted to be hip and trendy and cool. And the thing I'm seeing now is that like being trad is sort of becoming a fringe, cool, trendy aesthetic. You know, there's a whole thing going on in New York with like Dimes Square, where traditional Catholicism has become like a scene among 20-year-olds, and, you know, wearing crosses and going to mass. And it's like this kind of groovy hipster scene. Now, will that translate? Like, are they LARPing? You know, will that translate into actual marriages with three or four kids in a minivan in the suburbs? I mean, I hope so. I mean, it's like fake it till you make it. I'm totally fine with that. I went to a reading a few weeks ago, which was remarkable. It was myself, Curtis Yarvin, another Twitter anon, and we read from our writing. And this is in Los Angeles, and there was like 200 people there, all young, all cool. Like, what? it was a very hip scene. I know. I couldn't believe my eyes. I was like, I asked the crowd, I was like, where did you all come from?
Wait, so you and Curtis Yarvin were in person?
We were in person on stage together. Yep.
And somehow the universe did not split off into
Gen X for the win. Gen X writers are finally taking charge of mainstream American culture. And my takeaway from that was everyone there was literate, smart, educated, cool, and hip. And I think that becoming trad has to be something that's not like a cringe, like good old boy thing. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but to appeal to like 20-year-olds in LA and New York and Florida and wherever in big cities, you know, it is becoming cool. It is like the counterculture. And that's why, I mean, I call the book Domestic Extremists. We are a fringe aesthetic. And I'm hoping that is a little appealing, because the mainstream, the conformist stuff to do is to be your basic feminist, child-free, you know, loser. And, you know, we're the cool people. And I hope that people decide just because of that to join our movement, Emily.
Is there like a support group for right-wing like Twitter anons? Like, do you guys like all congregate?
There's a few group chats. That's all I'm going to say. Fed-proof group chats.
That's what you think.
Yeah, right.
Spoken like a Fed. Well, on that note, I have one final question, because your writing is unusually clever and sharp. And I say that because, you know, I think we're, as a culture, as a society, really losing our ability to write artfully. And that's what's so refreshing about your work. I think that's what's magnetic about it and why so many people love it.
Thank you.
On that note, who are some of your favorite writers? Are there people whose writing you really love that you feel like informs your style? Maybe I should even ask like comedians, because again, your work is really clever.
Yeah, well, thank you so much. That's so nice to say. I mean, you know, as a young person, I was obsessed with comedy. I was a comedy writer for a short time. I was a writer's assistant for a very well-known female television writer. But growing up, I loved comedy. I loved funny writers. And in those days, the main thing people read, you know, pre-internet, pre-blog were magazines. Hmm. So like I loved, you know, Anthony Lane's movie reviews in The New Yorker. You know, I read Harper's Magazine. I read Spy Magazine. I thought Spy Magazine, which is sort of like a parody satire magazine, which doesn't even really exist, is very much in line of like, the Harvard Lampoon, Saturday Night Live, John Hughes, P.J. O'Rourke, all these writers from like the mid 80s were sort of my idols because they were funny. And I idolized Dorothy Parker. I wanted to be her, you know, without the like dissolute alcoholism. But I thought she was great. I just aspired to be like them one day because being funny, that's how you became cool. And that's how you would become popular. And so my writing style has just, I mean, I've sort of always had this sort of whatever voice, but I have no interest in reading something that is like dry and academic. I mean, I read a lot, but I'm always drawn to people who are witty, who can make a joke, make me laugh. Cause I mean, there's a real art to that and it's hard to do, you know, I mean, I'm not a stand-up comedian, but I mean, there are some of the most brilliant writers. If you can write and like Twitter, having to tweet, you know, make something sharp and short and sweet in a tweet is great practice. And of course, I also benefit from working as a like an advertising copywriter, which was my main, you know, that's how I supported myself. For many years. And so
selling birth control.
I never sold birth control. Yes. I never sold out. Although I did once almost have a Margaret Sanger charity as one of my clients. And I had to turn that one down. I was like, I can't promote Margaret Sanger, you know, the founder of Planned Parenthood. So I did walk from that. But if you're required to write a pithy tagline or summarize this cool product in, you know, 100 characters, you have to learn economy. You have to learn puns. Puns are your friend. I mean, there's a whole host of kind of tricks that you have to learn. But yeah, I mean, I can't really name one writer. I mean, there's so many writers and there's so many great writers writing now on the right. It's sort of it feels like a rich time for content and writing and literature. On our side. And I hope to see a lot more of it.
Yeah. Well, if you want some of that rich culture, you should pick up a copy of Domestic Extremist, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. It's out June 6th. Click on the link for the cover alone. It's really cool. Peachy Keenan. You can find more of Peachy's work at peachykeenan.substack.com. Also, of course, on Twitter and at The Federalist, where Peachy Keenan is now a senior contributor.
Yay.
Peachy, thank you so much for stopping by and for being brave enough to do all you do.
Well, thank you so much, Emily. This is so fun. I'd love to do this again.
Oh my gosh, anytime. I'm Emily Jaschinski, culture editor here at The Federalist. You've been listening to another edition of The Federalist Radio Hour. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.